I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Good, The Dad and The Ugly, the fatherhood podcast. I'm Seth, a new dad, and on each episode you'll hear me and my good pal Jamie,
hello,
who's also a new dad, as we chat with our special guest each month about everything that comes with modern day fatherhood. Along the way, you'll also get the latest highs and lows and thrills and spills as Jamie and I foray further into these unfamiliar, joyful and often choppy waters.
Choppy waters.
Choppy waters. Choppy waters. Choppy waters.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of The Good, The Dad and The Ugly, the fatherhood podcast. It's me, Seth, and I'm here with Jamie again.
Hiya.
Hi, Jay.
Hi. Hi.
So, yeah, just wanted to get a bit of housekeeping out of the way. Thanks, everyone, as always, for downloading, sharing, rating and reviewing. That's great for us. It keeps, you know, it keeps the message out there, helps us get the pod as far as we can. So just carry on doing that as much as you can, anyone who hasn't done so already. Jamie, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I had a week off work. Yeah, I went to the Cotswolds for a couple of days.
Very nice.
Which was good. Yeah. No, it was some interesting experiences.
What kinds?
Well, the main one was we decided in our infinite wisdom to take her for a bit of a walk around. You know, you go to these places, you stay in the countryside, you stay in a pub or whatever, and you can see all these walks that you can go on. And we decided to take her for a three-mile walk. It takes a couple of hours, whatever, through fields and that. And we got a bit lost. And then she was on the kind of, you know, those baby Bjorn kind of like slings. Yeah. And she was really good for like majority of the time. And then she started crying. And we were like, oh, she's just a bit tired, whatever. And then she was crying and crying and crying. We're like, oh, we're a mile from home. She'll be all right. And we're like, maybe we should check her to see if she's like weed or pooed or whatever.
Yeah.
And we had a look and... not only she had pooed, she'd gone through every like the three layers of clothing she was wearing, the kind of blanket she was wrapped up in, and the sling that she was
in. How did that happen? It sounds like someone didn't do the nappy properly.
No, I think what it was, I think she shat herself and then was trying to let us know and we didn't really realise. And so then pissed loads, spread it around,
right,
and it kind of came flying out. And
that's kind of disgusting.
Well, we had to then... strip her down, change her on the side of the road. Loads of cars are like country road, loads of cars going past, completely naked. Then we had to wrap her. We couldn't then carry her home because the sling was all soaked through.
Yeah.
So I had to wrap her up in my jacket, my like tweed jacket. I was in the countryside, so I was wearing tweed.
Of course.
Yeah. My tweed jacket and carry a naked baby home for like a mile.
Didn't you have a change of clothes?
Yeah, but it was like the thinnest thing. Oh, right. And it was just, so that was a bit of an, we were basically, I wanted to take a photo of it. And if I didn't think that Nat would have killed me, right, had I just kind of gone, oh, wait, right, I just need to take a photo of this before I help you out here. It was fucking, I mean, yeah, it was.
Well, I tell you what, that you're lucky because she's not really eating solids yet, is she? Obviously not. She's only.
No, exactly. She's only 3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
So Eliza's like fully eating solids like three times a day now.
Does the poo change like that?
It's like. Human adult
shit.
Human poo.
Ugh. I saw my mate change his kids and he's like nearly two. And it was like, yeah, opened it up and went, oh, that's not a big one. Oh, it's just a little one. And it looked like the biggest shit I've ever done. Like, literally.
It was, and you've seen some big ones from it.
Well, yes, recently actually. I don't know why, but yeah. But honestly, yeah, I was like, how can you... It's when it's yellow and just like mush. You're like, oh, whatever. And it doesn't smell.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's that fine. Stuff is all right. It's like just milk, isn't it?
Basically? Oh, yeah. Yeah, rank. I think I keep thinking, oh, I've got this nappy thing changing. It was like my biggest fear was like nappies. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Nappies are fine. I think when I get to the solid stage. So go on, say what? So you had a bit of an incident with the...
Well, no particular incident. It's just like every time you have to change like the nappy, it's
human poo.
You have to sort of hold your nose sort of away a bit. But I suppose the saving grace though is that it tends to kind of keep in the same place. It doesn't kind of go
doesn't spill
everywhere.
Out,
it doesn't spill everywhere out
as much. Yeah, so she hasn't done many of those, to be honest with you. It's kind of just the odd couple have just kind of like been like explosions. But yeah, I think we've strayed into too much poo talk straight away.
We have. What else is new then?
Bits and bobs, really. Like we had to get her passport photo done, which is ridiculous at like, you know, just under 3 months. Like,
we had to do it because we were taking Eliza to New Zealand when she was 3 months. We actually got it done when she was 6 weeks.
Right. What's the point? She's not going to look like that for like... she doesn't look like that now.
No. Well, you could probably just about tell. But yeah, I mean, it's not like a very good...
If she was a terrorist, she'd get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. They should think about this.
Baby
but there
terrorist.
Isn't really... I can't think of a... I suppose you could do like biometric kind of...
Eye scan.
Yeah, eye scans.
They've probably thought this through, to be fair.
Yeah.
But what's new with you anyway?
Aside from the sort of, you know, the full-on eating, she's got a couple of teeth coming through.
See, when does teething start? Because someone said that they reckon Matty was teething, but that's too early, surely.
We thought it was starting months ago. Like when she was 5 or 6 months, she started like getting sort of irritable in the evenings and having this sort of rash like on her chin. And we were sure that's what it was. And maybe it was, but there was like no sign of teeth anywhere. But then just the other day I looked in her mouth and there was these two little kind of like things.
Teeth.
Just like, yeah, but they weren't fully, like you could easily not see it.
Yeah.
But in the last few days, they've just crept up.
And has she changed? Is she like getting really like is she in pain, do you reckon?
She's handled it remarkably well.
Yeah.
Yeah, she hasn't been too bad in the night, so.
It's amazing the things you don't know. Like, I thought I would be clued up on at this stage, but I have no idea when they start teething. I have no idea when they go to nursery.
I mean, for instance, like we've got a friend who's got a child who's a little boy who's just a little bit younger than Eliza, and he's had teeth for the last couple of months.
Right.
So I think it really does vary. And some people don't like teeth for the first time until like they're over one.
Okay.
So
yeah,
we should probably get on in a second, introduce our guest, but I just wanted to kind of make one last point because this is actually quite a big deal. We started sending Eliza to the childminder for the first time.
Oh, right.
This week.
Okay.
Because I was on the shared parental leave that I talked to a little bit about last time.
Yeah.
And it sort of ended finally.
Yeah. You've done
it. I had
now.
A couple of weeks where it was basically just me and Eliza as the primary care.
How was that?
It was like wonderful.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like easy.
It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah. But it was like, I mean, I feel so much sort of closer to her.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I know her, who she is a lot more than I
and
did
who is
before.
She? Who is she?
Well, she's a baby of about 9 months old.
Fair enough. That's it's probably
she's got two little teeth, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
She's almost crawling. But I'd take her to the childminder for the first time.
And leave her there.
And leave her there.
And how was that?
It was, you know what, like the build up to it, the sort of few days beforehand was quite kind of, I had this sort of sense of sort of impending sort of doom, uneasiness. But then the actual day of it was fine because the childminder that we're sending her to is really, really lovely person. And she was like, Eliza was fine when we handed her over because she doesn't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
I just sort of like dropped her off and was like, laters.
And then,
and then that was that. And I was like, she's going to be fine. So,
you weren't
she was.
And you weren't a blubbering mess.
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well done.
Anyway.
Good. Anyway,
we've
enough
rambled
about us.
On long enough. So, I'm going to introduce our guest now, Jay.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
His name is Shawnee O'Kane. He is an expert in domestic violence and an award-winning fatherhood specialist. I'm not quite sure what that means. So, Shawnee,
sure
can
we'll
you
find out.
Explain that?
I don't know what it means either. Still trying to work it all out. I was, hello.
Hello. Hey, we should start with hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Cheers for coming on.
Oh, no, it's grand, no bother.
Yeah.
Am I okay to start now? Or?
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like I interrupted you, but you...
No. I wanted you to... Well, you wanted I was also going to say that your other claim to fame is that you are a father, that's as all of our guests so far have been.
Yeah.
That's true. True story.
And also, like, I don't know, is it a claim to fame that you were ex-contestant on Big Brother? That's a claim to fame, right?
In some ways, it's... Yeah, it wouldn't be the top 10 best things I've ever done.
But it's well, for a lot of people, it would be.
But it's definitely up there.
Okay.
So I have got various accolades to my name in relation to fatherhood. So that particular one was from a charity called Passionate Pink, who I received outstanding contribution to fatherhood. And I think it wasn't just because of my own personal experiences of being a dad, but it was also because of the clients that I work with at the time, trying to help them improve their own fathering skills and also helping them be reconnected back into their children's lives that have been taken away from them by the mothers or social services or lots of different various issues as to why they'd been separated from their children. So I'd worked for extensively to ensure the children were reconnected back to their dad's lives in some way. So I think it was that particular award was... Personally, because of, I guess, they use a bit of my public profile with fatherhood and also the work I do, because I specialize in working with young dads and men and boys and fathers. And
how did you get into that work?
That is a very good question. I was on Big Brother, as you know. And
in what year was that?
That was, a long time ago, 2007. Was
okay. When it was still
when it was like when
a
I had
big
like
deal.
millions of people watching back then, and whilst on that show, me and my dad's relationship wasn't great growing up, or when I was growing up at least, and I always thought, I'd love to really piss him off in a really big way, and so I decided to come out on Big Brother.
Right.
And not tell my dad in advance. I thought it would really wind him up. And
I think that would wind a lot of people up.
Yeah, well, it did wind a lot of people up. That's probably why I was kicked out in some ways.
Oh, you were kicked out?
Yeah, well, I didn't win. So I had on Big Brother, I had the first gay kiss the week I was up for eviction.
And
that rattled a lot of cages, and particularly my dad's, because he was like, well, he's not gay, so I don't know why he's obviously doing this for just to be controversial, because that's the kind of thing he does,
right? Yeah.
And so whilst I was on the show, my dad told my family were hounded. They had to leave their village in Ireland. It was so bad, like they had reporters climbing in a kitchen window.
Really?
That is how, like, it sounds ridiculous because you think Big Brother, but we're going back like 12-11 years or something, and when it was huge. And it was many Irish people ever on Big Brother then.
So going back to you were saying about
how did I end up in this work?
Yeah.
So I knew I would come back to it.
Yeah.
And whilst on the show,
you're saying about your dad and that you came out.
Yeah, well,
on the show,
I came out on the show, etc. And my dad was, we're being hounded by reporters, and they asked, can we have a quote about your son having his first gay kiss on Big Brother? And my dad was like, well, he's not gay. And they're like, what? He's like, oh yeah, he's totally not gay. He hasn't even told me.
Because he'd be the first person you'd tell.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Yeah.
And they were like, well, oh my goodness, so he's deceived the whole of like Endemol and the British public. I mean, I was like, okay, he just does these things for a laugh. So literally on the front page of the paper the next day was I still remember the headline, Big Brother Shawnee is a big fakie. No, fakie's not a word. I don't think so.
Is it a word?
No, it's not an actual word, is it? I've never looked at it.
That doesn't usually stop them.
Of course. Right. And so it was like, the message boards, I remember going back and reading like message boards. Oh my goodness, he faked his sexuality. Like all these people have, they're really like real time discussions. They talked about it on Sunday morning TV shows, on like one of those political television programs about faking sexuality to progress or make it in the media.
But you weren't faking it.
No, I wasn't faking it. At that time, I'd come out as gay, and I was, and that's where I was in my life. I wouldn't say I'm gay now, but that's where I was definitely then. I mean, and there's lots of guys that can vouch for me. And so there's a, so me, I came out. So then Richard and Judy decided to talk about this. So they had a big thing about, you know, faking your sexuality and how can you prove? And Richard Madley was very involved in all this. And he's like, how can you prove it? How can you test people and stuff? So they're having genuine discussions. And then they say, well,
why don't we,
it's so ridiculous. And then they suggested, well, why don't we just bring him on? So wouldn't that be the most obvious thing? So then they brought me on. They said to bring on my dad because he was the one who said to the pair. And my dad is so, what's the best words to describe him? Simple, I would say. And traditionally Irish is probably another way of describing him. Anyway, so they wanted to also, I guess, discuss, you know, me and my dad's relationship. And because me and my dad never really been that close, although he was very physically available. Growing up, he just wasn't emotionally available in many ways. And so... And they were quite fascinated about this kind of father-son relationship. And that my dad said, you know, I really accept my son. And that was a big deal for my dad. They come on and say all this. And, you know, and he was really supportive. And to go back to your question, he asked, like, last Thursday, how did I end up getting into this work?
Sorry, I don't even know what you do anymore.
We were whilst on that show, after we did that show, we got lots of letters from the public who sent us. It was lots of fathers and sons who'd sent. I mean, we were so overwhelmed. In fact, they were still getting letters weeks and weeks after we'd done that show. And it was fathers who'd written in to say that they hadn't spoken to their sons or daughters for a long time because their sons and daughters were gay and they watched the show and it had changed their perspective. And or sons had written in to say that, you know, you've really helped me, you know, understand why I haven't told my dad about my sexuality. And after watching your show, I sat down with my dad and we watched the show together. I mean, the letters were, and I just did not expect any of this. It just was like the whole trajectory of where I was at that point.
So
my
you,
life
you
changed.
Didn't really know what you were going to like do with your life, I suppose, at that point.
Well, at that point, I was writing for a newspaper. So I was actually writing for a newspaper in Ireland, which is something I'd always wanted to do. So, and it was a newspaper, it was a broadsheet I was very familiar with in a media company. And so I was really enjoying it. And so all these letters come in and I was just quite taken aback. And I remember saying to my agent at the time, I said, hey, I really want to do more of this. I really want to do something around fatherhood and dads and kids. And he was like, okay. He goes, and he was trying to, I think in his head, he was trying to work out how he can continue to make money out of me as my agent whilst letting me pursue some kind of avenue around fatherhood, even though this guy has no kids himself. And he was just trying to work it all out. And it, in my kind of curious state at that time, I started researching about companies that work with and fathers and kids and stuff. And just it was 2008, and it just wasn't any. It seems ludicrous now, but it was like an alien concept in 2008. The whole thing about fatherhood and dads. But I found an NGO in London who worked specialized with young dads, and not only did I find this information out, but also they were looking to bring on someone or an ambassador to speak up about the relationship between dads and their kids. And I was like, I want to be part of this organization. I want to meet this organization. And my agent was like, oh, so you want to like maybe do a talk for them and raise their profile? I was like, no, I want to stop doing what I'm doing and I want to do this kind of work. He was like, you're insane. I said, no, I'm not. I'm being completely serious. I'm really passionate about this. He goes, you don't have any fucking children. I go, I don't care. It's not the point. And I go, you just don't get it.
Yeah.
And that was the thing. He just didn't get it. And so I contacted this organization and they were every single person in the organization was very aware of who I was. Because
what was the organization called?
Called St. Michael's Fellowship. So okay. I applied for the role there. And so I met the organization and I interviewed and they were just could not believe that this someone that they'd been watching on television had been like it was on the papers and stuff had just come for an interview for this organization and I got it and I was there for 8 years and completely And I started doing work with fathers before it was a real thing. I was literally given a blank canvas saying, you know, this is the only organization, this is actually the only organization, the main organization, the whole of the country at that time that was doing work with dads and young dads. So I specialized.
That's crazy, really, yeah, isn't it?
I specialized in dads between age 14 to 25. So that was my, that was where I spent nine years actually developing the fatherhood work there. And so.
And what kind of work did you sort of do on a sort of daily basis?
So I would have cases referred to me. Right. So I would come in the morning, I would get a referral would come in from the police or social services, or it'd be a self referral, and it'd be a particular dad, expectant dad, maybe a certain age. And then what my role was to connect with that person.
Yep.
To,
be like a father, figure
basically ensure that encompassing a lot of different things, practitioner, mentor, and you know, we weren't the police, we weren't social services, but I was I did a lot of work around child attachment, child development. My master's was in child and family interprofessional psychology practice, so I did a lot, so I knew a lot of things around.
And did you do this before?
My master's, I did it during whilst I was working,
right?
So I did master while I was working for the organization, and prior to my master's I did a lot of training around attachment and child protection, and so I was quite good at really connecting with clients early on in a way where they've had lots of distrust towards services and practitioners.
I was just gonna ask you if there's one example that really sort of sticks with you that you really.
So many. Like, I've really seen any kind of present issue affecting a dad, like when it comes to parenting, I've literally been right knee deep in it. I've experienced many issues regarding paternal discrepancy or misattributed paternity. I don't know if you know
what's that now?
There'll be times I'd be working with a client and I was working with a client who was 19 years of age. He was at university in Bedford, and I was working with him to prepare him for fatherhood. He was making certain life choices, and he didn't really, he was scared shitless. Couldn't tell his parents, and you know.
Was this a situation where he was at university?
The situation he was in, and my colleagues were working with the mother, or working with the mum, and I'm working with the dad, or at least one of my colleagues are. And I'm working with him to try and help him get his life in order in preparation for being a dad, so that, you know, when this baby comes, you know, you feel ready and engaged.
So it's not just, you know, dads who, like, you know, people who are already dads and have trouble seeing their kids or anything like that. It was all manner of.
Oh, yeah, of course, everything. Mm. It could be a dad might call me up because he doesn't understand why breastfeeding's important.
Right. Okay.
So this particular person, like, self-refer.
This particular person came free because we were working with the mother.
Right, okay.
And so that happens a lot. We'd work with the mums and they would say, you'd go into work every day and it would kind of be like, you know, you could almost have like, you hear the theme music, you'd walk in, it'd be like, you get the referral and you say, right, who's the dad? You get the profile and, you know, and I'm assigned to him and I'm going to make sure he's the best dad I can possibly be, and that's my role, and you know. And
what would your theme music sound like?
Oh goodness, it would be probably something really like the Benny Hill or something really clear, something, you know. It was so jolly and happy, like I was like, you know, I just love doing that. I love the work. And
you were talking about this guy that you were,
go back to your question is, you know, but one story that I recall that really stayed with me was, you know, this guy was 19 and he wanted some support around being a dad, and we're working with a mum and that's all good, and he's making some really big life changes such as dropping out of university, and his parents had wanted him to go to university, this particular university, and they were so proud of him. He was the first person in the family to ever go to uni, and you know, as he's dropping out, and it's a big deal, but he's so committed that they want him to be a dad to this kid. And whilst I'm working with him, I get a you know, one of my colleagues says, "Hey, Sean, you know, can I have a word with you?" I go, "Yeah, of course." And she goes, "Yeah, the mum has made a disclosure that he's not the real dad." And I was like, "Right." And I go, "Are we sure?" And she goes, "Yes." So, and I've experienced since that, this is the first time, but I've experienced that on numerous occasions
afterwards.
That's
parental discrepancy.
Yeah, and that's called parental discrepancy. Or misattributed paternity is another word for it. And so I said, okay, we need to let's meet up and let's discuss how we move forward here. So we discussed various options, and I had all these ethical dilemmas. At that point, I was a dad already, so I became a dad in 2009.
Yeah, we should talk about that.
So I was already a dad, so I already had the kind of fatherhood stuff going on and being a man, and not only that, knowing that, wow, this, I'm helping this guy make all these life decisions. I'm, you know, basically an accomplice and you know, the trajectory of his life. But also, not only that, there's another person out there that is the father.
Yeah.
And he's being denied. And so I had all these internal issues. And you know, we had decided that the best approach would be to encourage the expectant mom to tell him. That is the best approach because, you know, I couldn't play God in that instance. I also know that when you know you're becoming a dad, and for many of my clients at least, it's the one instigating factor or a catalyst for change.
Yeah.
And that, you know, many dads will stop smoking because they're about to become a dad, or they'll drink less, or they'll want to get fit, or something about an element of their personal life, or that they want to change because they're becoming a dad. And that maybe this this young man who believed he was an expectant dad might have known that he wasn't the actual dad. And he, for all I know, might have just wanted to be a dad. It might have given him a sense of purpose. It might have given him a real responsibility. But then there's other aspects of fatherhood I know that exists, and we forget what that's like. That this person's, this 15-year-old kid's experience of being a dad, like me, universally, we've got this concept that, you know, of what fatherhood is, and we're both dads, but your life as a dad is so different to mine. And then you think, well, because it's so different and it's less enriched, how does that impact upon the way you parent your child? And out of all the, you know, out of all the fathers I've ever worked with, professionally, you know, despite the issues that are presented to me, whether it could be there's domestic violence or gang crime or you know, different substance misuse. So one thing that is very apparent is that, you know, all these men really love their children. You know, my master's study was looking at how maternity services engage young expectant men to ensure that they're better involved fathers. Yeah. And across the board with midwifery staff and social workers, and particularly then when I was doing that work, there was this, mostly with local authorities, there was this kind of census that, you know, particularly with the child protection cases, that dads were very much, the children on the child protection cases because of the dad's behavior and harm. And in many cases, dads are often seen as the problem, and, you know, and therefore they're not included in child protection meetings for whatever reason. But I really believe that if you work with dads, despite what the issues are, they can be the solution. If you really give them the tools and you listen to them and find out, well, why do you think he is behaving in this way? It's okay, you can label him as being a monster or being whatever, but actually let's try and instead of you know, constantly labeling him as the issue and the problem, let's focus on dad and see what can we do to ensure that he gets the right support and mechanisms so that he stops harming his partner in a way that he is. I don't know what your experiences are. Probably very different to, say, a young 17-year-old black guy in Brixton when I turn up at a children's centre and they're asked, you know, are they lost? Or, you know, oh, well, where's mum? Or, yeah. You know, dads who don't have their kids maybe that weekend, but when I go to a children's center to check it out for the time they do have their kids, and they turn up and they don't have a kid, and it's like, whoa, this is all really shady. Why is this guy turning up and he doesn't have a kid? And like, you know, the way that the stereotypes of young dads, when they, like, you know, I remember dads, you know, I've worked with, you know, they were so afraid of pushing a buggy. It was because they'd never ever pushed a buggy before, and they're suddenly gone from, you know, being on road in Brixton to now pushing buggies, with, you know, going
so
from being the boys.
Of being seen by.
Yeah, all of this, you know, I did a campaign a number of years ago called the 100 Dads Walk, and the idea was to represent dads walking into their children's lives as opposed to walking away from them. So we got 100 dads with buggies, and we did it outside the Brixton Library. We did it for 3 years in a row, and it was just a really. It's a real powerful message that, you know, dads can push buggies. It's fine. It's cool. It's fine.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it sounds ludicrous. But when you are that age and you're a kid becoming a parent, and your dad isn't around, and you suddenly have to take on this whole responsibility of being a dad.
I can't really like comprehend how difficult it must be if you're like basically a child yourself, and you have to be a parent too.
But that's why I tell people all the time, my friends and stuff, you know, they talk about fatherhood all the time, and I said, well, yeah, it's great, isn't it? Imagine if you were 15, imagine if you were 17, imagine you'd just come out of prison, imagine if you were in prison.
Okay, that's the end of part one. More after this.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So tell us a little bit about your setup.
Okay.
of your family isn't exactly the most sort of traditional nuclear family.
Some people
it?
Probably will have had every kind of word under the sun, but unorthodox is a word that we had.
Okay.
So where I am at now is I've since come out of a 3-year relationship with my ex-partner, and she was Egyptian Arab. So I was with her for 3 years. And so that's where I come back to sexuality. So I'd kind of fluctuated in and out, shake it all about. So I was with her for 3 years, and we recently broke up. And so it gets very confusing when people see pictures of us, and they assume that she's the mother of my child.
Right.
And she's Egyptian. My son's black, Zimbabwean, half Irish. So we can imagine, like, in fact, actually, every time we're in public and, like, we see another white man with a black child, it's like a big deal. My son like loses his shit. He's like, oh my God, look, there's another one, Dad. So do you want to know how this all happened?
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
How strong are your stomachs?
Yeah, they're, okay. I'm on a full stomach, so I think I'm okay.
Okay, it's fine.
I'm all right. Okay, I'll take it.
So a number of years ago, pre-Big Brother, pre-coming out, I was sitting with my then girlfriend watching the TV. I was very young, my early 20s. And there was a show on about people who couldn't have children of their own. And I am very sensitive to, I would say, women's pain. It's probably the best way to describe it. You know, there's lots of testimonies on the show, a BBC program, about heterosexual women and heterosexual couples and single women and lesbians. And basically, it was all these people who just wanted to be parents and they couldn't be for lots of different reasons. And I was really taken aback. And I was like, wow. And I had my Messiah moment. Like, I could give someone the gift of life. Let me help them. And I was like, oh, my, at the end of the show, it said, you can, you know, put yourself forward to be considered for a sperm donor or a co-parent. And I said to my girlfriend, this is amazing. I can do this. She was like, no, you're barmy. This is not amazing. You're a kid. No one's going to want a kid.
So how old were you at the time?
I was, it was 2006. So it would have been about 25,
okay,
24.
So young. Yeah, so young enough. 24. Yeah.
And so I said, no, it's great. And I really, and sometimes when I get in my head, I'm going to do something, I really want to do it. And that was a Friday night. And the next day, I put up a profile and I put up lots of really suspect pictures, like, you know, me outside next to like a flowery field and just really silly pictures and all. And I look very whimsical and magical and, you know, and so I imagine that, you know, anyone seeing it was like, oh, God.
No. He looks like a laugh. He looks, definitely dad material. Like,
so it was a complete opposite of dad material in every way, shape and form. And I, what I didn't realize is that this show went out online. So on a Tuesday when I went to check my emails, there was just so many responses. And there was a woman from Canada, right, had actually offered to come over to Canada and try to make a baby. And I was thinking, how short is a sperm supply in Canada? It's bizarre. And it was completely, like, I was a bit overwhelmed by it all. And but one of the email responses that I seen and was from a Zimbabwean lesbian couple. And one was a nurse and one was a sign language teacher. And I really liked those qualities. She seemed very humanistic and lovely. And I just really, really liked these two. And they just really stood out. And we spoke for a little bit back and forth.
They living in Zimbabwe
they
at
were,
the time?
No, they were. That's all right. A lot of people ask that. Sorry, I should make it clear. They were living in Essex.
Okay, so very different.
Yeah. So a lot of people always assume that. And so they said, listen, yeah, it's great you're in London now. Why don't we have a test? Why don't we have a practice go? And I was like, okay, I'd literally been in the country for like a couple of weeks. That's not true. It's probably a couple of months, I would say. And I said, hey, listen, okay, let's do it. What does that involve? I mean, and I was thinking like, do I sleep with both of them? Do I sleep with one and the other one watches? Like, do I
do I buy them dinner first?
Yeah. It works. Like, do I like freeze my sperm and give an ice cubes and give one to her and one to her? And I don't know, I was like, you know, they were really vague about like logistics. And I just like, I was, my heart was saying, oh, you have to help these women. And so I was like, okay, let's do this. And they said, they go, and they said 80% of the time it's not going to work. In my head, I heard that we have to do it at least 80 times before it will work.
That was your logic.
That's what I heard. It's like, oh, it's fine. So even if it doesn't work the first time, then and we don't get on, then like looking back now, we should have at least met up and chilled out and did all their stuff, played crazy golf
for a drink or something.
Yeah, or, you know, and there was no, and people say, you know, but was there any legal agreement or did you were you not clear about what it was you wanted? And I said, well, you know. You know the song, all that she wants is another baby? What was that? Is them. That's all they, yep. They were the Zimbabwean Ace of Base, and that was who they really had their sights set on having this, you know, this child. And I was just like, yeah, let's just do it, and sure, you know, I'll be involved. And they were like, oh, well, we'll talk about it later on and all that. It was all quite, like, vague and, you know, And they said, we're going to come round and we're going to just do this practice go and we'll see how it goes. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And they said, yeah, could you just have everything ready for us? I was like, yeah, that's fine. That's not a problem. It's easy. And I go, right, okay. And so it was a I'll never forget, it was a Friday evening in October. And yeah, I was waiting for them to come round. And I lived with a guy called Ursino, who was a sommelier at the time in Hakkasan. He's a really cool guy. And he wasn't around. I was in the house myself. And I can't really romanticize this, but I shot into a polystyrene cup. And was really pleased with myself. And I was like, yeah, they're going to love this. I was thinking, should I wrap it up? I don't know. What do you do? Like a gift tag. And then whilst it was in the cup, they said, oh, we're caught in traffic. We're going to be late. And I was like, okay, that's fine. So I wish I could had a camera watching me at that time, because in my state, I started to panic because I assumed that when the sperm gets exposed to air, it starts to die. So I turned the oven on a low heat. And I put it in the oven. Because I assumed...
Not the fridge.
No, because my balls are warm. So why why would I... My friends, I said, why didn't you put it in the freezer? But like, because it's just come from a warm place. Why would I want... Unless I was like... You know, like a snow monster or something. I mean, why would I want to put it in the freezer? Mix? And also, it's quite unhygienic.
Right.
So the oven is completely sterile. And so I put it in the oven on a low heat, and it was in there for about 30 to 40 minutes. And when it came round, I'll never forget this. I just, it was like another person now. When I look at me then, now it's just like two different people. And when I pulled it out, it all kind of decrepit. It was all crumpled up. But the sperm was like intact and it was still moving around. And they were just happy because they just wanted sperm, you know. So they were like, yeah, it's great. Give us all sperm. Give us all your sperm. And then I was like, okay, so do I like turn one of you upside down and pour it in? How does it work? These were really clear and there was nothing really on. Like,
you can't Google baster. That, can you?
Turkey baster.
Yeah,
is that
they'd bought a home insemination kit. And
because they'd come prepared.
Yeah, of course, because it's all that they want is another baby. So they knew exactly what they want. And so they were like, okay, so where's your room? And I was like, it's in here. And I was like, I mean, what? Do I watch? Do I have to instruct? And they're like, oh, no, you can just wait outside. I was like, okay, sure. And they're like, yeah. And I go, okay. So they went in the room. I didn't even know which one of them was like, I thought maybe they were going to half it. She was going to have him. She was going to have half. They weren't really. I hadn't really talked to her. And so, and then I just waited, and they came out of my room like half an hour later, and they were like, "Okay, well, thank you." And I was like, "Oh, thanks." Like, okay, well, I'll see you later.
You don't want to stay for some like?
No, there's not. I didn't want that. I had elderflower champagne and all there, and they didn't want anything. So they left, and then that was it. So I was like, okay, so I'm gonna go out with the boys tonight. So I went out with all the lads, and we were all drinking all night, and they were like, give me loads of stick. and whilst we were out, I was getting hammered, and I get a text message from who would then be the non-biological mum, and she said, hey, you know, thank you for your sperm today. I never got that text ever before. I got it that night. I've never got it since. And she's like, oh, you know, it was really kind of you. And I was like, oh, thanks.
I think every like one night stand should finish with that text. Thank you for your sperm today.
And she said, you know, but did you know that, you know, styrofoam kills sperm? And I'd be like, well, no, I fucking didn't go to sperm school. How would I know that?
But you're saying the oven doesn't.
And she said, you know, we've just read up on it and we'll come around tomorrow for some more. And I was like, oh, well, like, when tomorrow? She's like, early. It's like, fuck. Okay, I said, boys.
You've had a few drinks, basically.
I have to go. Because the lesbians are coming for sperm tomorrow.
The lesbians are coming. They come back and they're taking my sperm.
And they were like, and so I was like, I have to go. I can't stare at any longer. And so my mates were like, okay, go home. Piss off. So I went home, went to bed, woke up the next day. And My housemate at the time had broken up with his girlfriend that week. So he was already in a really pissed off mood and he was out playing football. And the Saturday morning, it was lashing the rain. And you know, you've all been in a situation before where you're trying to have a wank and you can't, and you're and it's not getting up for whatever reason. And you're slapping it about, or, you know, any kind of sexual activity. And it's just like, well, I was really under pressure and just could not rise to the occasion. And, like, you know, how many times have you had a group of lesbians come around to your house for your sperm and you had
all the time for me?
Any couple of times.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I can't keep them away.
I was really under pressure and I just could not give it up. And I was like slapping it and talking to it, and I played like power ballads. And, like, nothing was working.
Serving caviar.
Elder Flash.
Something, none of it. And so I think it must have just been really hungover. And so I was really panicking, and the panicking was making it worse. And I was like, oh my God, they're not going to want, they have a kid with someone who can't even get it up. And during this madness, my housemate Ursino comes home completely drenched, covered in mud. I don't know if he'll ever hear this story. He will kill me for this, but he's covered in mud. And I'm like, are you okay? He goes, are you okay? And I go, oh, yeah, but African lesbians are coming around and they want my sperm and I can't get it up and I'm just really distressed. And he goes, oh my goodness. I go, are you okay? He goes, well, we lost. I go, oh, it sounds awful. He goes, is there anything I can do to help? And I said, well, I go, it's going to sound really silly, but could you give me some sperm? Because, like, this is just a practice go and it's not going to, like, you're not going to get pregnant. So, like, it's just a practice go and that's going to be really, humiliating if they come around. I can't even give them any. And he was like, of course, that's fine. It's not a problem. I said, well, but don't put it in the polystyrene cup because I kill sperm. And so I gave him, cut off a bottom of a plastic bottle. He had one and I had one. I went into my room and tried to calm down and read Reader's Digest or Tattler magazine or something. Just kind of take my mind off it. And by the time I come around, I was able to perform. It was all right. It was all good. Everything was fine. And they came to the house and I give them my man juice. And
but it was yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was mine. But as I did that, he came out of his room with his sperm. And he gave his sperm to them and I give them mine. And they were like, oh, thanks. And he was like, right, well, I'm out. So I'll see you later on. I was like, all right, bro, see you later on. And then he went into my room. And this is, I swear to God, this is a true story. Everything I'm telling you in this is absolutely true. And I remember every single second of it. I remember what I was wearing. I remember what they were wearing. And they came out again half an hour later. And they were like, okay, well, thank you. And see you later. And I was like, okay, bye. And that was it. And then they left. And I was like, okay, well, I've decided I don't want to do this again. I'm glad we had the practice sessions, but this isn't really for me. And it was all good. And I didn't hear from them until 14 days later. 14 days. 14. To tell me that they were pregnant. And I was like, that is great. Who is the dad? Because it can't be me. Because, like, does it not take, like, a couple of months? Or something. I was just, you know, it was like, not 14 days. It seems like a month at least. And I was like, okay. And she was like, yeah, we're really excited. And this is great news. And I was in my head, I'd already prepared for myself, well, we're never ever going to have a kid together because it just isn't not going to work. And so I went back and I didn't know how to, I was so taken aback. I didn't know, like, how to broach the conversation about, well, who's what? And so I told my friend, and he just lost his shit. And he was, and for like days and days, me and him were like he was a state. He couldn't do his work properly. We were trying to work out, like, what if it comes out with, like, your chin and my, like, hands or, like, your feet, like, my hair. And we've got, like, this, the hybrid child of both. He's Venezuelan with a square jaw. And I was like, what's it going to look like? And he was, obviously, we didn't pay attention to biology at school. Anyway, so these days went on and all this. And I decided to say, like, you know that whenever I give you, like, you took my friend's sperm, they're like, oh, about that. She's like, that was so nice of him, but we threw it in the bin. So I could have just, we had, remember, days of torture. I'll never forget. That was really distressing.
That would have been one of your more uncommon parental discrepancy cases, wouldn't it?
Of course. Yes, it was a very, very unorthodox parental discrepancy. And, you know, so you know, I'm not going to bore you so much with the complexities of my role as a father during the pregnancy, because it was all, I'd say being a dad has definitely been the most difficult thing I've ever had to endure. Maybe I'll change that. Being a father in the way that my journey has led itself, that has been very difficult. And I think it's because me and the mums are so different in many ways.
Yeah.
And we didn't really know each other. And there's been times where it's been really, really challenging, where, you know, we've considered going down a legal route. And despite all of that, we always seem to get through it. And, you know, the reality is that they wanted a child, rightly so, for themselves to parent and for me to send a card on the child's 18th birthday, for example. And I was just like, well, no, I kind of want to be involved. And, you know, in some capacity. And they were like, well, that's not what we, it's not our intention. I go, well, we weren't really clear. And
yeah,
I think
that would be something that you talk about.
Yeah,
you
know, lots
first,
of stuff.
Right?
There was, you know what, in hindsight, yes, lots of things would be different. And I stopped now. I've had my own mental health stop thinking about those things a long, long time ago. You know, and so during the pregnancy, I remember they'd moved up to the back arse of nowhere in Mottram in Manchester, and an hour away from Manchester. And I felt they'd moved because they didn't want me to be around. And they were, you know, heterosexual couples don't have to take on a third parent. So why do they become a homosexual couple? But because of the laws of science, you know, it takes a male to make a child. And so, and I'm a big advocate in having a dad around. And so I just felt like, wow, they have had a child with the wrong person.
Yeah.
They've had a child with a man who works to get fathers involved.
Sure.
They've really drawn the short straw here. That whole mythical fantasy of the Irish leprechaun thing that they wanted is completely gone out the window now, because they just didn't realize who they were having a child with. And I think they were naive in that part. And so, you know, when they moved away and they wouldn't communicate so much, and they did tell me about the scans that was happening, and, you know, and one of them let slip of when it was happening. I turned up, I went up to the scan on that day, and they nearly dropped dead. I was there, and they were like, oh my goodness, it's so much easier to get rid of genital warts than this guy. He's just like, he just won't leave us alone. You know, my son's half, you know, he's black and he's Irish, and, you know, I actually have two moms as well. So I've got a non-biological mom who's native Cape Tonian, and her husband is Indian, and they've got three kids. So you're like my brothers and sisters. They're Indian, Muslim, half black. And so my brother's married to a Japanese girl. So my son is, you can imagine, my son is got this whole like wealth of culture and ethnic backgrounds, and he travels the world a lot because we all live in different places, and so he is totally worldly and unfazed and just so like progressive for his age, and he just totally gets it. He doesn't misbehave very much, I must say. He's a very good kid, and everyone he's ever met my son will always say the same thing. Oh, he's very polite. That's the one where they're like, oh, he's so polite. You know, God, he asks me if I'm okay or how's my day and blah, blah. Like, we get off a bus, he'll always thank the bus driver. he's that kind of kid, right?
Does he get that from you?
Yeah, probably. But I don't, because I'm not aware of myself sometimes. I'm like, oh, wow, he's just, you know, I love the way he's like that. Because I always think he's totally not like me in many ways. In fact, I actually sometimes like, you know, we are, how are you my son? We are not alike. And
maybe
not
it was
we're
my
not
flatmates.
Like. Yeah, maybe it was. No, if you see my son, he's exactly, he's like a black version of me. It's just, it's scary. And so, you know, he's, you know, when he's really badly behaved, I'll say to him, you know, excuse me, Cousy. My son's called Kuziva Aiden. That's the thing when Irish people have kids of Africans. You don't warn you in advance, but they have a million names. And he's got so many names, he has a separate page on his passport for his names. It's ridiculous. Like Kuziva Aiden, blah, blah, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, I don't know, all these big long names. And so I said, you know, Kuzi, excuse me, son. I go, where did you used to live? And then he'll roll his eyes and say, oh, in your balls. I'll say, exactly. Do you want to go back in there? And he's like, no. I'm like, right, okay, we stop it. And that's the one that always gets him to, like, because no one wants to go back into their dad's balls.
And what is it? Do you see him? Is it like a weekend thing? Do you see him like every
so
weekend?
I get him every other weekend. In fact, I'm getting him this weekend. But I also get him, it's supposed to be every other weekend. Sometimes it's 3 weekends. Sometimes it's 1 weekend. I had him for 3 weeks over the summer. I'm going to get him for 2 weeks in October for half term. I don't get him for Christmas this year because his moms have him. Listen, no one will ever know unless they actually do it. But no one that I've ever spoken to for all the years of being a dad, what it's like to parent a child halfway across the country. And I've been doing that for almost 9 years because I've been running up every other weekend since the pregnancy, almost during that period. And that has really, like, impacted upon my mental health in so many ways. Like, I have no consistency because, like, the times when I was working for a company, my holidays would always be, I'd take off Fridays to go up to see my son. So I'd never have any holidays because it would be all, like, the amount of money I've given Richard Branson just to be in the same room as my son is insane. Like, I can't even properly save for him because I'm constantly spending money on travel just to see him. It is nuts.
And they're still putting it out. They're still putting the prices up, even
perhaps
though they can't.
If Richard Branson's listening to this, he could refund you some of that money.
Maybe she'll give you a loyalty card or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, probably. Well, I mean, it's just,
hats off to you. That's dedication and
yeah,
half,
so hard. I tried to work out all the hours I've spent literally just traveling to see my son over the past like 8 years, and like, you know, how much time like I could have been spending actually with him.
We've talked about what you used to do, you know, where you used to work and at the St. Michael's Fellowship. But tell us about what you started your own practice called Think Fathers.
Yeah. So I found that during my time at St. Michael's, as a specialist fatherhood practitioner there, that I was working more and more with DV cases, but they're just
DV cases,
domestic violence.
Yeah, right. Okay.
There just wasn't like many perpetrator programs that existed, particularly in Lambeth. There just wasn't many programs to help rehabilitate the men. And what usually happened, I found, is that like local authorities would kind of, again, come back to the point I made earlier about men, fault perpetrators and men being the problem, that they would just kind of fall to the wayside, or they'll end up in the criminal justice system, and that's sorted. But it's not sorted, and the problem never, and that doesn't rehabilitate them, and then it's this vicious cycle. And what I tried to do in my work was, you know, end that cycle. I worked with some fathers who were first, second, third generation of not never working, or had been fathers have been in prison or whatever. And my aim was to break that cycle. I wanted to stop that in its paths. I wanted to do everything I could to make sure that they were given the right skills and resources and tools to have a different life. And so one of the reasons why I started Think Fathers was purely because I felt there was a gap whereby the perpetrator programs that not many existed, and the ones that did very much worked with men in groups. And I found from my experience, when you work with a person in a group environment, particularly when it's about really sensitive issues like domestic violence, they're less likely to open up about what they've done because of shame and guilt and lots of different reasons. And I'm quite skilled at working in a very, very therapeutic way with individuals in a one-to-one environment. And so Think Fathers has the various elements. You know, the essentially it's Think Fathers, Think Men, Think Boys, and it's really given men, boys, fathers voices and giving them abilities to change behaviors if needed, and also to celebrate being a man and being a boy and being a father and all the good things that comes with that, and how that really impacts positively upon their children's lives and partners and families, and also I work in partnership with local authorities and the partners to see if they've noticed that the changes are happening.
How sort of successful is that, do you find?
Well, I have 100% success rate so far with the clients I've worked with.
What do you deem as a success?
When they do not continue to reoffend,
really,
using harmful behavior.
So I just sort of, um, I, I don't expect that anyone who listens to this will have this opinion, but I know that there are probably people out there who, you know, just playing devil's advocate, who might say, you know, like, why spend time like sort of rehabilitating these people? Like, do they really deserve it? But it sounds like, you know, it's largely about like the kids, really, and like,
yeah,
making sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think I said something earlier about that with all the dads I work with that I can recall, the one thing that they have in common is that they love their children. And so when I put, it's very, and it, sometimes it's very difficult initially for the dads to grasp why, you know, why they're in the wrong or accepting responsibility for their actions. And but what I do is I really put the children at the forefront of all their decision making, and actually they feel the impact of the harm, even if it's not directed at them, it's directed at the mum. And when I make them understand that if you shout at the mother or the partner, you know, in an evening time when they're in bed and they can't hear it, or when, even when they're not around, it's getting them to understand that how her behavior has been altered or affected and how that impacts upon her parenting, whereby the children are actually being neglected because of his harm. Mm-hmm. And getting them to see that actually I love my child and I didn't realize I'm hurting my child by my behavior. Getting them to grasp that, because they love their children, they don't want to harm their children, and the penny drops, that's when we move into a different, the therapy kind of moves into a different area. That even when a father has been a perpetrator or has harmed a partner but is willing to change, I still think he's a really positive factor on that child's life.
Yeah.
I think once it, you know, from my experience of removing the dad and child in any way, is it's as damaging,
right,
as domestic violence is itself within a relationship. So,
Jamie, I noticed you've got a few boxes over there,
yeah,
beside you.
Yeah.
Brightly coloured packaging.
It's, yes,
quite interesting. And there's some like egg shaped thing.
Yeah.
Like, so, what can you explain what you've,
well, this is dad tech. Okay, so here we have two things. I'll start with the egg-shaped thing that you spoke about. This is the Grow Egg, the Grow Egg 2 by the Grow Company.
Right.
Have you seen one of these before?
I haven't.
So basically, I've got it here, as you can see.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's growing red. And basically, what it is, it's a thermometer and a nightlight which goes in your child's room. And what the Grow Company have done in conjunction with the Lullaby Trust, which is a safer sleep for babies charity, it researches the prevention of SIDS, which is
sudden infant death syndrome.
There you go. Yeah, and basically what it does, it tells you, you see the readout here on the egg, it's quite a nice design, it's saying it's 27 degrees in here at the moment and it's glowing red. Now, if it got cooler, it would drop down to an orange light, and then further past that, if it got to sort of 20 degrees, it would go to yellow, and if it got to 16 degrees, below 60 degrees, it would go blue. And basically the idea is that you can have a quick look into your child's bedroom or your baby's bedroom, and with just one look, see if it's too hot or if it's about the right temperature, right, for your baby, or too cold.
Yeah,
so blue would be too cold.
I know if I'm hot as balls.
Yeah, exactly. So for you,
right,
you know. A baby doesn't know.
Sure.
And you don't know necessarily if you're putting the right clothing on your baby,
yeah,
like the right TOG, you know, Grow Bag, which is by the same company. The Grow Bag, the original Grow Bag, by the same company.
I mean, how did cavemen survive?
I know, right? That's,
how did they get through parenting?
Well, this is what my fiance Nat always says. She's always like, there are tribes in the Amazon who have not met like other human civilizations, and their babies are fine. But still, come on, look, we have the technology, we might as well use it.
Right? I'm all for it. I know the Lullaby Trust. I know some people work in the Lullaby Trust.
So they're working with the company,
yeah,
to kind of produce these products. Yeah. And I think it's really good. Anyway, this sells for $29.99 in all your major retailers. And I'll move on to the second thing by the Grow Company as well. This is the Grow Clock. This is spelled G-R-O. They're both G-R-O without the W. And this basically is to help sleep train. Well, I guess sleep train your kids. You set it and there's no time on it. Right. There's no sort of actual digital clock on it. There can be, but you can turn it off. And basically, you set the time you want your kids to wake up, whether from a nap or from a sleep. And the sun that's on the display, the yellow sun on the display, will turn blue into a blue nighttime star. And it'll be surrounded by lots of little stars. And through the time that you've, you know, set, say you set it for like 7:30 in the morning.
Right.
And that's the time you want your child to wake up for school or whatever. The stars will start disappearing. Mm. And then your child will know that when the last star disappears, that's time to wake up. And the blue star will now turn into yellow sun. And it blinks and it kind of winks at you and it kind of goes, you know, time to wake up.
Right.
So basically, no matter what time you set it for, so you could then at the weekend kind of go, oh, I want a bit of a lie-in. So I'm going to set it for 9:30 this morning.
Yeah.
Your kids will still know that it's, because they're not looking at a clock face and they're not looking at a digital clock. They know the time to wake up.
I still get confused with, you know, like the old school clocks, to be fair.
Yeah, I know. And you get, and the 24-hour clocks as well.
Yeah, that goes right over my head.
Well, this would be perfect for me. Well, I road tested it last night, and no joke, I woke up twice in the night, and the first thing I did was look at it to see how many stars were left. I'm not even joking. And then this morning, I set it to wake up at 8 o'clock. I got up at 7:30, and I was excited. I watched it for 3 minutes to see what happened when the last star disappeared. And when the last star disappears, it turns yellow, big sun comes up, and your kid knows it's time to get out of bed. So I think it's quite good to sleep train, and you get a free little book to read.
That's cool.
And yeah, and it's kind of cool.
And how much is that one, did you say?
So this sells for about £19.99. So they say at the Grow Company, we believe safer sleep for babies means a good night's rest for the whole family. And I guess that's the whole thing that they do, is that all these like sleep aid and safe sleep products. So yeah, the Grow Clock and the Grow Egg, two, I think they're good products. I've road tested them and they seem
is there any dads in the box?
No, just a baby again.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Nope. It's just a baby there and a baby.
Are you
there.
Wondering why it qualifies as dad tech?
No, I just want to I just find that lots of packaging when it comes to promoting products like that to parents.
So no, this is parent neutral.
Okay, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a thing.
No, it's good. I mean, yep. No, it's good. I'm because they're not many are, so it's right. Good to see that, just to be aware of these things.
Yeah. So there you go. That is Dad Tech.
Well, I think that just about wraps up episode 10. Thank you, Shawnee, for coming on.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
If people have listened to this episode and really kind of liked and been interested in what you've been talking about, how can they get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me. Probably the easiest way is probably Twitter. Just my name, Shawnee O'Kane. S-E-A-N-Y, O-K-A-N-E. Or if you type in Think Fathers, I also come up on Twitter as well.
Jamie, thanks again.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yep.
And thank you, the listeners, obviously, for tuning in. And join us again next time. Next time. Next time. Next time. Next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.